Good afternoon. I greet you from Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 1997. In the fireside room this afternoon, the teacher is Tom Evans. Today, Tom will be leading a session titled The Holden Mine, Discovery and Operation.
The slides. I want to show some slides today of the discovery of the Holden Mine and its operation. And so if you're looking for the mission and other talk that Martin's giving, that's down the hall. This is a chance to move on down the creek side if that's what you want. But I'm going to be talking about the Holden Mine and how it operated and give a little bit of information about the village in addition to the mine itself. Wait for everybody. If you could reach back up there on that and just pull that last button on the back side all the way forward, can you see it? Which one it is?
The one with the light in it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it?
Yeah, that'll do it. And if that gets fuzzy, somebody can just reach up there and twist that focus. Some of these slides were made at different times, and so there may be some fuzziness on it. Jonathan, as you're walking by, could you just flip those lights right there? Thanks a lot. That's fine. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the history of the mine, and how it was discovered, and how it was operated, and how it ties into the settlement of Holden Village. I'm a geologist. I work with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, and so I am as much, if not more, of a visitor, if you will, to all of this as you are. And so I've been reading about the mine and learning about it, and I encourage you, if you get a chance, to go up to the Portal Museum. Now, they have some really excellent displays up there, and other slides, other than the ones that I'll be showing, I have other slides to show as well. Give a real good picture of the story to mine. So what I'm going to do is give you kind of an overview and hope that whets your appetite enough to go up to the portal. If you get a chance, take the mine hike with Rick Dunning. He spends a lot of time talking about the very, very early history of the mine, more than I will spend today, in terms of its discovery and some of the legal ins and outs of how it was eventually brought into production. So it's very interesting to trek, and if you get a chance to do that, it's well worth your time. This is a shot from the switchbacks coming on up into Holden, and I put this in here to kind of emphasize the fact that what we're talking about is really the discovery and operation of Washington's largest copper mine, largest copper producer in the history of the state of Washington, and really one of the most remote locations in Washington. And this, of course, this combination of the presence of this very significant mineral deposit in this very remote location is one of the reasons why, for example, the mine was not developed earlier, is because of this location. But one of the reasons why it's very unique in our thinking today is because this is a fairly large operation that was developed on a relatively low-grade copper deposit, but in a very remote location. And so there's some fairly unique aspects about its operation, which we'll talk about as we go along. It was basically discovered, if you will, by J.H. Holden. Now, it's a little clear, the records are a little unclear, but when the Great Northern Railway came through this area, came up Railroad Creek Valley here, naming the creek, looking for a location for a rail line to go across the North Cascades. This was in 1887. There is some evidence that Holden was a member of that party. But Holden himself was born in 1855 and came out back in Massachusetts, or came out west in 1874, was involved with some mining activities in Nevada, some mining and assay activities in Colorado, eventually moved into the Seattle area in the 1880s and became a friend of a Denny family in Seattle. And those of you from the Seattle area know the Denny family name is very well known in that area. And Holden became a part of, if you will, of that family in the sense that he was employed by them and spent many years with them. Holden came into this area in conjunction with the Denny family. They would come over here for outings, picnics, and one thing or another. They were very much interested in mining and had a whole broad variety of business interests. And Holden was interested, of course, because of his experience in Nevada and Colorado, in the minerals in this area. In 1892, Holden came up into this area, made the discovery of what was the lead. This is kind of an apocryphal story, if you will, but the story goes that they was ready to leave the valley, was hunting for food before leaving, shot a deer, followed the deer that he had wounded, and the deer had died basically on this ledge of rock, which turns out to be the discovery outcrop for the ore body. He had apparently seen a ledge from across Martin Ridge, across the valley, over towards Copper Mountain, could not find it, and then shot this deer, and the deer ends up landing on it as Holden trailed it on. Well, I don't know whether that story is true or not, but it makes for an interesting story. What Holden eventually did, without going into the details of his relationship with the Denny family, they ended up in court, had to be settled by the Washington Supreme Court and all this kind of stuff, but basically what Holden did was file claims in this area after this discovery. If you go up to the Porter Museum, you can see some of the paperwork that's there in one of the cases. There's something like a total of 15 claims that were filed in this area. Now, a claim was roughly about 20 acres in size, to give you an idea. So there were a number of claims filed in this area. This area was subject to the 1872 mining law, and these claims that were filed in accordance with that, and eventually they became patented, which simply means that Holden came to own the claims and own the land and the minerals both on Copper Mountain. So it went from public hands into private hands. So the mine and the mill, a portion of where the tailings are sitting, are actually private lands owned by Holden Village Incorporated. But the rest of the land in the area, of course, is owned by the U.S. Forest Service. Holden had these claims, and these claims are like property. Okay, there is things that he can lease them out, he could sell them, they became his. So this is how Holden kind of made his living. He lived in the Chelan area, and he more or less leased out these claims to people who would be interested in leasing them. He worked the claims himself. He would take ore, he would go to these mining shows in San Francisco and whatnot, and he would try to interest people into investing in the possibility of opening up a mine up Railroad Creek Valley, up Lake Chelan. And this is a shot of a work party in 1909 that was up in Railroad Creek Valley. They would come up, they would work the claims, follow some drifts, dig some drifts into the hills, get some samples, and basically try to test out the extent or nature of the ore body. So they would do this work periodically. Usually when people were doing this, the money for this was coming from the sale of stock. So Holden would be selling stock periodically in his company and using that money then to finance the kind of exploration work that would be necessary to eventually prove out the deposit and hopefully entice somebody into buying the whole kit and caboodle. So it's kind of interesting in a way. Holden is credited with the discovery of the Holden mine, which is true. And he did a little bit of mining, but he really never opened the mine himself. I mean, this was all kind of development work and peddling the property and selling stock. And it was enough to give Holden a livelihood in which he lived quite nicely down in Chelan. Eventually, he ended up borrowing money and selling stock also to a guy by the name of Crooker Perry, who lived in Chelan. And Holden himself died in 1918. Crooker Perry, of course, was one of the creditors, and part of his paying off of the loan that he had made was to get some of the stock from the company. And eventually the company basically became Crooker Perry's company. Now Perry then was a little more aggressive. He went out and enticed Britannia Mining and Smelting Company in 1928 to come in and take an option, a lease on the claims, and then an option eventually to purchase 4 years later. So this is a picture of Crooker Perry, and he peddled this claim and these claims in a way in which Britannia leased them in 28, eventually purchased them for a little under $250,000 in 1932. So Britannia Mining and Smelting Company was quite serious by this time then about developing this. While they had the claims in the lease, they were working the claims, defining the ore body, determined that there was enough there to be economic, and now they had to satisfy the question of how are they going to work it in this remote area. So they began in the late 20s and early 30s to build a road, the same road which basically you come up on into the village today. So this was the task of trying to get what they determined to be something that they felt was economic. How were they then going to be able to get that ore out of the mountains and down to the nearest smelter? The nearest smelter, of course, being in Tacoma. There was some talk about building a smelter in this area, but not for very long. Nobody's very interested in doing that. They already had a smelter in Tacoma. You can't support a smelter with just one mine. So the idea was, the real key here was transportation out of the mine, again, a fairly low-grade ore body, how to get this low-grade ore out from the mine, down valley, and eventually over to the pole. So they had to construct the road, and gradually, of course, that road was improved, and we'll see later on just how they got the ore out. But let's go spend a little bit of time going into the mine. Now, this is the mine portal, which still exists today. It's up above. If you go up to the Portal Museum, that's where the old assay house was. So the mine portal itself is up a little bit higher. This is about 3,500 feet in elevation above sea level. It was called the 1500 level. And out of this portal, if you will, out of this opening into the mine, all the men, all the materials, all the ore moved in and out of the mine from this one location. That portal was driven straight back into the ore body, and the materials were removed by electric locomotive, if you will, in and out of the portal. So the ore would come out this way, the men would move in this way, back and forth. Again, electric powered equipment, both to carry men as well as to carry ore in and out. You can see that the drifts in here are roughly around, in the main haulage ways are like 12 feet wide and about 10 feet high, would be the size of one of the mine drifts.
There's a question over here on the right.
Say again. What?
Do the miners got other tunnels to get in the mine?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing that, because I'm hearing the motor of the thing.
Do the miners that mine in the mine, they come in one tunnel?
Are there other tunnels going into the mine?
There are some other openings into the mine. Of course, they have to create openings for air to move into the mine and out. But in terms of active haulage ways and passageways, this is the opening into the mine. There would be some other minor openings, but they were not openings that would be used by men or be used by materials or things of that nature. There was some little bit of exploratory work that was also created, but this is the 1500 level, the main haulage way. There you go. That's all right. Once into the mine, of course, you had to get access to what were basically 14 different working levels in the mine, and that was done primarily by a shaft. The mine, the 1500 level, is not at the very top of the mine. It actually comes in the middle of the mine. So shaft number one, which is really what miners would call a raise, is not really a shaft going down, but a raise going up, was actually constructed, and the upper ore body was worked first. Later on, this is shaft number two, which is working a shaft which is working the lower workings. And then men and materials will be lowered down this shaft. It was actually a kind of a five-compartment shaft that had two parts, one of which there would be what was called a skip going down empty, and one would be a skip coming up full. And so, basically they would have skips going up and down two of the compartments. Men would be going up down a third one. There would be an emergency compartment, and then there would be another one which housed all of your air lines and your power lines going down. So these were very large. This particular shaft was like almost 19 feet in one dimension and 12 and a half feet in the other dimension. The operator of the shaft, the one who operated that the tramway going up and down, was basically very important because he controlled the flow of materials as well as men in the mine. Here's another shot of the hoist room in the number two shaft. This is a picture. This is a diagram which is also out on the. If you walk out the road towards the miners' village, you'll come across one of the displays which shows this particular diagram. I just put this in here because I know you really can't. You really can't read this, but you can get an idea if you go out and take a look at that diagram. It explains pretty nicely how the mine was worked. But this is like the 1500 foot level coming in, and the ore body is sitting right in here. The ore body is sitting right in here, and it's about 80 feet wide in terms of mineralized zones, about 80 foot wide, and then it would be about 800 feet or so. Excuse me, about 2,500 feet or so from top to bottom, and about 800 feet, a little bit more, along the strike coming out from the stream. And it's in that ore body then that they would create the openings or stopes out of which they would pull the mineralized rock. They would create a series of drifts that would go along the ore body, and then some of the drifts would cut across the ore body. And that would be their access. And they would go into those drifts, and from those drifts they would also be then drilling and accessing the ore. And I'll have some more pictures here in a minute of that. Once they would start a drift like this, they would have to be sure that it would be cleared of loose rock so that men could use the drift safely, would not be subject to falling rock. The rock in here is very competent, so once they had drilled and blasted out the drifts and cleared it of loose rock, as this mucker is doing, then it was safe, pretty safe to operate in. It was not a mine which was characterized by a lot of roof falls or anything of that nature. The rock itself was predominantly competent. And this would be a drift that would be about 8 feet wide, about 6 feet high. And this would be one that would be all cleaned out. And you can see the air lines going in, pumping in air. These are what the drilling rigs would look like. They would be one or two men drills that would be on a drift that would go across the ore body. Then they would drill down into the ore body. When they drill down into the ore body, they would be taking samples of the rock, okay, of the ore. It's very important when you're dealing with a low-grade ore like this that you know precisely where the ore is, what is making ore, and where the waste rock is, because you don't want to be producing waste. So they would. I think there was something like over 10 million feet of drill core drilled over the course of this operation, somewhere between 10 and 12. They kept records how much footage was drilled and this kind of development drilling. there was somewhere between 10 and 12 million feet of drill core actually taken. They would be drilling at various angles as they would go down into the ore body. There are various patterns of drilling that they would follow. And eventually they would, in those drill holes, they would place dynamite. And some of them, early on, they would place dynamite in boxes in what were called blast rooms, areas that they would widen out, they would fill with dynamite, and then that's what would blast the rock. And later on, and from the mid-40s on, they were using basically blasting of gun dynamite, blasting powder going down actual drill holes. What they would create then is a series of stopes, or large rooms in the ore body itself. And what they would use is gravity. They would come beneath an area that they wanted to mine out with a drift. Then they would go take drifts up into the ore body, and they would leave them. Okay. What they would do is try to blast a rock right above that, and then that rock would fall, and it would fall down those drifts, and down to basically the slusher drifts where they would move the broken rock out. So gradually you're working the ore down from below. And then they go up and drill up on top, fill that with dynamite. Once they created the opening down at the lower part of the stope, they could go from the top, drill down into it, set the dynamite, and that would keep blasting the rock down. And they would create these very large rooms. You can see the man at the bottom of this drift. This is about, I think this is on the 1500 level. Where he's standing has been filled below that. So he's standing in a very large room which has been mined out. So they would have drilled down in from above and blasted down into an opening that would be created below his feet, for example, in this particular case. And they would use gravity then to help them break the rock. So you kind of have, there's a lot of development work that goes on in a mine of this nature. Drifts going underneath the stope that you want, ore passes going up into the ore, and then you create the opening, and then you go up and you're drilling from the top down, blasting the rock down the opening, down those ore passes, down the drifts where it's hauled off, and eventually taken out everything out of the 1500 main entry level.
So a drift is essentially a tunnel?
It's essentially a tunnel.
A stope is a big room that's formed by blasting out all the rock. And
this is a stope, right, and this would be a big room that would be left.
So they have they tell them to drift at the 1500 foot level, and they'd make this lower area, then they take another drift, say at 1600, and blast down, and then up at 1700, and is that what you're saying?
Yes, in general, that's right. What they're doing is basically working from the top down. Once they started to develop a drift and got it developed with the ore passes in place and the slusher, what are called slusher drifts in place, then they would be going down from the top and allowing that to then fall and go down the ore passes and into the slusher drifts where it's mucked off in carts of this nature and dumped down razors and finally down to the main haulage way, to your haulage drift, which is going to be at the 1500 level and out. Now, this is when they're working above. Now, when they're working down below, they're doing the same kind of technique. But what's happening down there is the rock is going down further down into the mine, where it's going down to primary crushers. It's being crushed at that point down to about 6 inches in size, and then that crushed rock is being hauled up the shaft up to the 1500 foot level. It's going to come out the 1500 foot level on an electric train and then go to the mill. The mill was sized initially to run about 1,000 tons a day of material, and it was later increased in size so they could handle 2,000 tons per day. It's a little unclear, reading some of the records, whether or not the mine worked, the miners actually working in the mine worked 7 days a week, 24 hours a day or not. It doesn't seem like they did. The mill almost certainly worked around the clock. Once you get a mill like this set up and operating, you don't want to shut it down because it's very sensitive to the chemistry of the material coming into it, very sensitive to the chemistry of the materials being added to it. And basically it works like this. when you're taking 5- and 6-inch rock, the thing you need to do is to crush it down to about 1/4 inch or 3/4 inch in size. But what you're gradually working on doing is reducing the rock in size to where the mineral grains are the same size as everything else. And then when you got it to that size, then what you're trying to do is separate those mineral grains out from the rest of the rock. It's just simply a separation process. So your copper-bearing minerals, which in this case are chalcopyrite, the copper, iron, sulfide, generally comes in a particular size range in an ore body like this. So the idea is to eventually crush the rock down to about that size range. So they do this through a series of, these were a series of jaw crushers, which would take, which are basically breaking the rock with the movement of a jaw, and then to a series of what are called ball mills, which are big drums with 2.5-inch steel balls in them. And then these big drums would rotate, and that would further reduce the rock. And you're gradually getting the rock down to smaller and smaller size. Okay. When you've got it down to the size that you were looking for, and let's say it's basically a little bit like a sand-sized material, then you're adding with it, you have water with it, and then you're adding chemicals with it. And the chemicals are acting essentially like a soap, creating bubbles. And then what you want is to create the right chemistry so that the copper-bearing minerals will attach themselves to the bubbles and will tend to float up on the top of these big flotation tanks, some of which were 10 feet deep, big flotation tanks, which is simply being stirred. And it's like a big froth, and you keep scraping off that froth. And what you're doing is concentrating the copper. If the copper in here is running at around 2% to 3% copper in your ore, you're trying to produce a concentrate that's in the upper 20s percentage of copper. Otherwise, it's just too expensive to haul. You don't want to be hauling 2% copper anywhere because there's not enough metal to make it worth your while. So what you've got to do is concentrate it, and that's what the mill is all about. The mill would do 2,000 tons per day, and it would operate 7 days a week. What it would produce is what is called concentrate. All the metals were contained in one concentrate. This mill produced copper, zinc, there was some silver, and some gold as well produced. And I'll show you some figures at the very end of how much was actually produced. This would all be in one concentrate. So as they produce this concentrate through the action of the mill, reducing it in size, gradually separating out the metal-bearing minerals from the waste material, they're producing a concentrate which is very wet, so they have to dry it out. They dry it out to somewhere around 8 to 11% moisture, and then they've got something that they can afford to haul. So they would put that concentrate into these kind of barrels, which the barrels themselves weighed something like around 1,500 pounds. And they would be able to put about 5 tons of concentrate into each of those barrels. This is a really bad photograph, but that is a truck which has 3 of those concentrate barrels on it. And it's going to go down the road, down towards Lucerne. Where you got off the boat, this is where they're going to take the concentrate down and put on the boat and take it down lake. I can imagine driving one of these trucks in the 1930s and 40s with 15 tons of material behind you down those rows, those switchbacks, basically operating year-round. That must have been kind of a hairy ride at some times. So they would take the concentrate down the road, again down the switchbacks, down to the dock at Lucerne, which is basically about in the same place where the dock is today, and you can see the crane on the dock, and that crane would be taking the barrels of concentrate then off the trucks and putting them on the barges. This barge looks like it has about 40 of those barrels on it, so that would be about 200 tons of concentrate. And I believe there would be something like 2 to 3, 4 barge loads every couple of weeks would go down lake to Chelan. This is a shot of one of the first loads of concentrate going out in 1938. When the mine opened up, in earnest in 1937 with a lot of development work, but the first shipment of concentrate didn't take place until April of 1938. This is a big thing in Chelan. This mine opening up, the jobs that it was going to create, it was all the news in Chelan, if you will. And so they would take it down to Chelan, they would offload the concentrate there and unload that concentrate into rail cars to take down to the Tacoma smelter. This map gives you an idea. If they're moving from Holden up here down the 12 miles, 11 to 12 miles down to Lucerne, then the 40 miles down lake to Chelan, and then they had to go by rail from Chelan down towards Wenatchee over to Everett, and then down into Tacoma to the what became the Asarco smelter at Tacoma, is where the material was eventually then smelted. You can get an idea of how expensive, what the cost would be in this kind of movement of materials to a smelter. A lot of handling of the concentrate in the barrel form, it's very expensive to do. You're shipping it down lake by barge, which is not all that expensive, but it's also not all that efficient. And then you've got to handle it again at Chelan, put it into rail cars, and handle it again at Tacoma smelter. There's a lot of costs involved in this. You're probably talking about, toward the end of the life of this mine, something on the order of 28 cents to 30 cents per pound of copper of cost. So when we talk about the price of copper in just a minute, we get an idea of why this got to be uneconomic. Of course, in the concentrate that you're producing, maybe 5% of it to 10% of it is going to go out as concentrate. The rest of it, 90 to 95% of the rock you're handling, is waste material. Material that has no economic value and must be disposed of. This is a one of the old tailings lines. Again, you can see these things if you walk up the road up to the Porta Museum, and just before you get to the Porta Museum, just look to your right, you can see one of the old tailings lines coming out, in which it's made out of wood, wrapped with wire, but the slurry of crushed rock, waste material, then would be piped out, pumped out to the tailings holding area on the outside. Now, a large amount of tailings also went into the mine itself. They used it to fill up stopes that they had worked out to give them a better handle on ground control, because they didn't want to have collapsing going on. So by filling them with tailings was one thing that they did for a while. They did that from about the mid-1940s to the early 1950s. And then they stopped doing it. It's about 1.8 million tons of tailings in the mine itself now. So some of it went back into the mine. Much of it, as you see, of course, all along Railroad Creek. There's about 80 acres covered with tailings along Railroad Creek. And it was piped out in a series of lifts. The logs here kind of formed walls, if you will, behind which then they would put the tailings. So this was created in a series of lifts, and we see them now today as called levels. So this covered a lot of the area in this area. This is typical technology of the time. The company was concerned about Railroad Creek, and trying to protect Railroad Creek. To my knowledge, there was only one accident handling the tailings at the time, in terms of actual having environmental damage of the kind where you might have a failure of a tailings dam. It happened early on in the late 1930s. Tailings made it all the way into Lake Chelan. They redesigned everything at that time, and then they had very good success handling the tailings from that point on. But this is clearly one of the biggest issues associated with the mine, is the handling of so much waste in such a confined space, and a space in which you need to be very conscious about the environmental values as well as the economic values. remember now, this is most of this is now going on Forest Service land. This is not private land. And the Forest Service is very concerned that it be done in a way that's proper. We have people in the village today who are continue to study the tailings with the idea of looking at eventual reclamation of the site and management of the environmental impact of the tailings. Now some, a little bit about the town of Holden that grew up around around the mine. This is a shot from Martin's Ridge looking down on the on Holden Village in the lower left portion of the slide. And then you can see the mill building built along the side of the hill. The mill building was built that way so it could take advantage of gravity as this gradually crushed smaller and smaller rock could move downhill, if you will, in a slurry form eventually to be dried out and shipped off or to be disposed of as waste material in the form of tailings. So this is a shot from Martin's Ridge back towards Copper Mountain, over Holden Village, over towards the mill. This is a shot in 1937 of what the community looked like. Halsall Mining Company had a problem on its hand. It had an ore body which it felt was economic, but it had to create essentially a community in which the miners would want to live and want to stay with them. It's very important for a mining operation to have miners who are productive and who are relatively feel safe operating in the mine and who are happy and want to stay at the site. You want to minimize your labor turnover. So there's a lot of economic incentive for the company to make this as reasonably pleasant an experience as possible. So they constructed Holden Village. The lodges you live in are the old dormitories. The dining hall is in the same place. The recreation hall, the village center. All of this was constructed by Halsall Mining Company in accordance with U.S. Forest Service specifications. This is on Forest Service land. The buildings are owned by now by Holden Village, but the land itself is, of course, leased from the U.S. Forest Service. So they had to create a community in the middle, essentially, of nowhere that the miners would be willing to stay and live and be able to be productive. One of the things, the single miners, the single miners stayed in the dormitories. But one of the things that creates stability in your labor force is having married miners also and families. And so it was important to create the space in which the married miners, their families could live. And so they created a place called Winston Camp, which is now called the Miners' Village. As you walk out the road, you can see where the old Miners' Village was. There were over 100 homes that were constructed in the Miners' Village. These were homes that were individually owned. The people who built these homes owned them. The land that they were on was leased from the Forest Service. There were over 100 homes out in the Miners' Village. I think I got one more shot out here. And this is looking down from Copper Mountain, from Honeymoon Heights, and you see the large number of homes that are out there. There's only one structure still existing out there today, and that's the old Campfire Girls house, meeting house. The reason none of these homes were left after the mine shut down in 1957, and yet all the other buildings that were in were left, the reason the miners' houses were not kept up was because, one, it created a heck of a task in trying to maintain all of those residences. And so the Bible Institute, the Seattle Bible Institute, who originally got the property then from the Halsall Mining Company in the early 60s, did not want to maintain essentially 100 individual houses, didn't feel that they needed it for the purposes that they wanted it for. Those were all individually owned houses at the time. They were not owned by Halsall Mining Company, they were owned by individuals. So eventually, the Forest Service bulldozed those houses down and burned them in the early 1960s. But these are the chalets, these are the houses in which the supervisory and management personnel for the company lived. down in the village itself proper. And of course, this is the main street familiar to you as you come into Holden, the main street. They had a store, they had a church, they had at least a church facility. They did not have in the village a Lutheran church or a Methodist church or a Catholic church. It was an interdenominational religious facility, if you will, that could serve as a meeting place for all faiths. Basically, did not want to create structures which would create divisions in the community. They had a school. In the school, when you have this many families living here year-round, you have to provide schooling for the children of the family. The school here went from first grade through eighth grade. When they got into high school, basically they went down lake and boarded down lake in Chelan and other areas and went to school for high school down in the Chelan area. The gymnasium, which is our village center today, was, when it was built, the largest gymnasium in the state of Washington in 1937. And it became a focal point for community activity. Dances, as you see here, movies were shown about three times a week, two times at night, one time on Saturday afternoon. They had basketball facilities in here. They had basketball teams in here. They're very competitive. They had created a lot of competitive sport league kind of things for entertainment in the village. Of course, the pool hall, which is in the same place that it is today, the pool hall and bowling alley were also centers of recreational activity for the community. When you have 350 miners working, essentially 600 people in the village total, you need to provide activity for them so that it creates an environment in which they are comfortable, in which they are safe, in which they are productive. I read someplace that they had at one time 16 men's teams, 8 women's teams, but bowling on the same bowling alley as you can see today was quite an important activity. Why did the mine leave? I mentioned that it opened up in earnest in 1937. The first concentrates were shipped down lake in April of 1938. The mine operated until June 28th of 1957. And what was going on during that time? The mine was very successful, particularly during the time of the war. And the U.S. government had struck a deal with House Sound Mining Company where U.S. government would buy half of the production of copper at essentially 30 cents a pound. So that gave a stable price for at least half of your production. However, what was going on in the mid-1950s was the price of copper was dropping. And the price of copper in 1956 was somewhere up around 46 cents a pound. In early 1957, it had dropped down to 24 cents a pound. So it's getting really low prices. So their cost of production was somewhere around 30 cents a pound. I mentioned that it was 30 cents a pound. The government price support was actually 32 cents a pound. So they were making only a couple cents a pound off the government. So when it got down to below 30 cents a pound, they're losing money. It's getting more and more expensive in the later years of the mine to work because they're working now at the lower levels. Because of that, the stopes, they began to work smaller and smaller scopes. It's getting more expensive to work that. There's another thing that's going on besides the drop in prices. For an operation of this nature, the federal government provides a percentage depletion allowance for a period of 20 years. This allows the company, because they are depleting a resource, to make a deduction on their tax liability in recognition of the fact that they're depleting a resource. In other words, they work they're just working themselves out of a job. So the government would subsidize these kinds of operations by allowing them to deduct half of their income so that would not be taxable. That exists for a period of time. And in August of 1957, that depletion allowance break was to end. And so the tax burden that the company was going to be bearing was going to go up significantly. So copper prices were going down, mining costs were going up, your favorable tax treatment that the company had early on was phasing out. And all of this then came to the decision that they were going to shut down. When the mill shut down, this is what this is a shot of, when the mill shut down in June 28, 1957, it shut down literally overnight. Now they knew that the mine was going to be shutting down. It's not necessarily as if the miners one day had a job, the next day came and nobody there. But basically when the mill shut down, it just simply shut down. It was never to start up again. There is crushed rock at the top of the where the mill is. There's crushed rock ready to go through the mill. There's unprocessed material still in the workings of the mill today. There's ore in the mine itself. When the time came to stop, they simply stopped and began the process of leaving the Holden area. The portal itself, you can no longer go back into the mine. The portal you can see, you can go up to the third level area and see the portal. You can't get back into the mine because it's collapsed. The rooms further back in the mine are open, but the tunnel going back in has collapsed, or at least part of its distance. This is the production which came out of Holden, and with today's prices, I figured this up about a month ago, somewhere around $450 million worth of metals were taken from the mine. Over a couple 200 million pounds of copper. You see the copper, the zinc, and the silver. And then finally, a little bit of gold. But of course, gold, even though it's a small amount, was a significant contributor to the economics of the mine. This is about out of 10 million tons of ore that was actually handled in the mine. So with that, I'll stop and see if there's any questions you might have, and see if anything else you'd like to talk about. Maybe you can turn on the lights back there. Yeah.
What was the primary reason for the decline of the price of copper?
For the decline of the price of copper? Copper, a couple things were going on. Large copper ore bodies were coming online, mainly in South America. Mm-hmm. Copper is an internationally traded commodity. So the control of the price of copper, if you will, is controlled by international markets. Supply and demand, for the sake of argument. Probably a little more complicated than that. You get involved in companies who control major percentages of the market and kind of cartel-like actions. But at this particular time, what was really going on was that the market was becoming flooded with copper. Mm-hmm. And so even though there was a demand for copper, there were plenty of places to get it. And so the competition was driving the price down. And if you couldn't guarantee yourself a certain price, then everything fell back on your mining costs. How much did it cost to mine and mill it? And when those costs were so close to the price, again, only half of their production, see, was guaranteed at 32 cents a pound. And that was, a subsidy from the government, okay, because the market price was below that. So when you only had half of it what you're making a profit on, it became real critical to know just exactly how much you were losing on that other half. And it got down too low where they just simply couldn't sustain it. Yes?
Is there any idea of how much of this low-grade ore is still in the mountain?
I've never seen a figure on that. It's clear that there is ore that still remains in there. But you got to be careful when we use the word ore, because ore has an economic parameter associated with it. I mean, if it's not economic, if you can't produce it at a profit, it's not ore. It's just mineralized rock. So technically, there is mineralized rock that remains in the mountain. But whether or not it's ore, of course, it depends on whether or not you can produce it economically. There's not enough to restart a mine in this location, for example. You could never support the infrastructure costs that you would have to create to start it up again. That kind of ore does not exist anymore in the operation. Yes?
Have you had a chance to talk to the Dings and Moore people? Do you have any sense of what type of contents in the tailing or what type of leachates or...
No, I just chatted with them just very briefly, but I haven't had a chance to talk with them at any length as to the kinds of work that they're doing and stuff. A comment about that it would be, however, that one, you should talk to them.
Oh, well, I did on the bus, but I can share what they said actually.
Yeah, the obviously it is a continuing issue when you have 80 acres covered with tailings, you have Railroad Creek. In an international forest, you have a continuing issue of what kind of ongoing environmental degradation is going on related to those tailings piles. It's interesting to speculate about legal culpability. Holden Incorporated, of course, owns the claims, and that's part of this issue. Once you touch one of these environmental quote-unquote Superfund sites, for the sake of argument, it's tough. Once you've had any kind of a legal liability associated with it, it's tough to get rid of that liability. There is liability that goes with the successive mining company who took over the Howe Sound assets. And that mining company has some legal liability, of course, for this, and the Forest Service is interested in stabilizing the environmental situation here, as well as recouping some of its costs, which is somewhere around $4 million that the Forest Service has spent. The direction of the efforts that are going on now, which and Dames and Moore being hired by the mining company to advise them on that, I don't know the exact directions of that reclamation effort, what kind of data they're finding, but
if it's appropriate, I could say what they told me on the bus up.
What?
Questions.
Say again?
I could relate what they told me on the bus up, if anybody's interested, but there might be other questions.
It's something from Dames and Moore who would maybe speak to that a little bit about what's going on, or not? That's okay. I mean, I'm just curious whether they were... Over here. Okay. Other questions? Comments?
I just have a comment. I'm a lifelong Tacoma resident, and I I can recall when I was 7 years old in the summertime outside playing with my friends and tasting the sulfur produced by the Asarco smelter. And I also witnessed the implosion of that smelter about 5 years ago, so kind of interesting.
What happened to a lot of the displaced workers from the mine?
Well, once the mine shut down, they had nowhere to go. I should say they had nowhere, there was no reason for them to stay here. They had to leave. And so, in many cases, many of those workers moved on down into Chelan. There's a significant number of workers here. They moved on to other mining jobs in some cases. I'm trying to think what the percentage is, somewhere around 40% of the labor force that was here throughout the life of the mine. And so many of those workers, of course, had reached the age where they were going to move on to, when this mine closed off, we're not going to move on to another mine, but settled in the Chelan area. They have reunions for the miners every so often. 1977 was a 20-year reunion, 82 to 25-year reunion. So they have them every so often where they will come back into the village. There's, again, some good information about the miners up at the Porta Museum. There are also tapes, sort of oral histories, if you will, from the miners and some of the families. When they have come back in, they've shared some of their recollections and remembrances And so that's also available to you in the tape library. Other questions or comments? Okay, well, thanks very much. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you.